5 of our Drugs and Intelligence series tonight. The Summer of Love and the CIA, or the CIA and LSD, a couple of acronyms that seem to go very well together.
Now, we've been taking a look at the LSD phenomena. We saw, first of all, how LSD research in this country essentially was engendered by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the funding for its mind control work. We then took a look at how the people, many of the major figures involved in LSD proselytization during the 1960s, were introduced to that drug via people strongly connected with the intelligence services research into the drug. We last looked at Dr. Timothy Leary, reports of, quote, CIA-connected people being in Leary's group, said Leary's relationship with Mary Pinchot, who was in turn the wife of Cord Meyer, a key CIA official intimate with the likes of Frank Wisner, Alan Dulles, Philip Graham of the Washington Post was part of the Cord Meyer circle, and Mary Pinchot was herself murdered, in all probability, a political assassination, very shortly after President Kennedy was assassinated. And recall that she informed Leary that the CIA was, in all probability, monitoring his research. That's intriguing in light of the fact that a key old OSS official was involved with as the department head under which Leary first undertook his research into psychedelics at Harvard University. We're going to take a look at Leary and his intelligence connections, and specifically those of a group that Leary was affiliated with called the Brotherhood of Eternal Love in just a second. First of all, we're going to take a look at the CIA's involvement with the Haight-Ashbury itself, specifically monitoring the Haight-Ashbury and quite probably doing research into it. Returning again to Acid Dreams by Martin Lee and Bruce Schlain. According to a former CIA contract employee, agency personnel helped underground chemists set up LSD laboratories in the Bay Area during the Summer of Love to monitor events in the acid ghetto. But why, if this assertion is true, would the CIA be interested in keeping tabs on the hippie population? Law enforcement is not a plausible explanation, for there were already enough narcs operating in the Haight. Then what was the motive? A CIA agent who claims to have infiltrated the covert LSD network provided a clue when he referred to Haight-Ashbury as, quote, a human guinea pig farm, unquote. Let me repeat that last sentence. A CIA agent who claims to have infiltrated the covert LSD network provided a clue when he referred to Haight-Ashbury as, quote, a human guinea pig farm, unquote. And what better place to establish a surveillance operation than the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco? A dozen years earlier in the same city, George Hunter White and his CIA colleagues had set up a safe house and begun testing hallucinogenic drugs on unwitting citizens. White's activities were phased out in the mid-1960s, just when the grassroots acid scene exploded in the Bay Area. Suddenly, there was a neighborhood packed full of young people who were ready and willing to gobble experimental chemicals, chemicals that had already been tested in the lab but seldom under actual field conditions. In addition to the spooks who inserted themselves among the drug dealers, there were scientists with CIA backgrounds who stationed themselves in the acid ghetto for monitoring purposes, unquote. Dr. Louis Joylin, J-O-Y-L-O-N, Jolly West, an old-time LSD investigator for the agency, rented a pad in the heart of Haight-Ashbury with the intention of studying hippies in their native habitat. So make of the human guinea pig farm statement what you will, and the presence of Louis Joylin West in the Haight-Ashbury, make of that what you will. The point being, again, that even in the very sort of cultural center of the psychedelic phenomenon during the 1960s and 70s, the Haight-Ashbury district, the CIA was very heavily involved with it, and perhaps, who knows in what capacity they were involved with it or perhaps creating it.
In the course of back announcing some songs, I made a snide reference to the fact that the famous LSD-inspired song White Rabbit is referred to these days as being from the soundtrack of Platoon. I should say that, of course, there is not entirely unjust, because one of the things that was going on very heavily in the 1960s was the use of serious narcotics by American ground forces in Vietnam. The Acid Dreams cites figures as high as 15% of soldiers returning from Vietnam as being hooked on heroin. One of the other drugs that was a very popular choice in Vietnam was LSD, and we're going to be talking about where a lot of that LSD came from.
Now we're going to take a look at the organization called the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, which was the largest single underground source of LSD during the 1960s and 70s. It's a group that became very closely affiliated with Tim Leary, as we're going to see, and as to exactly where the intelligence community leaves off and the brotherhood of eternal love begins is something that we are going to determine, and perhaps could not be determined, because the saga of the brotherhood of eternal love is once again totally inseparable from the U.S. intelligence agencies.
Yeah, it's not unlike a hippie Hughes Corporation. Reading from Acid Dreams, one type of acid was particularly popular among American ground forces in Vietnam. It was called, quote, orange sunshine, and much of it was smuggled in from Southern California during the late 1960s and early 1970s. Far from the rice paddies of Southeast Asia, a group known as the Brotherhood of Eternal Love was waging its own holy war of sorts in their tireless efforts to turn the world on to LSD. During their heyday, the Brotherhood ran the world's largest illicit LSD ring. Ironically, their base of operations was Orange County, home turf of Richard Nixon, Disneyland, and the John Birch Society. We will see later if that's actually ironic or not. The saga of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, Lee and Schlein write, is a bizarre melange of evangelical, starry-eyed hippie dealers, mystic alchemists, and fast money bankers. Federal investigators described them as, quote, a hippie mafia of approximately 750 people that allegedly grossed $200 million. But the Brotherhood's secret network of smugglers lived by a code different from that associated with organized crime. They were fired with idealism, committed to changing the world by disseminating large quantities of psychedelics. At least, that's how it was at the beginning. It all started back in 1966, when a motorcycle gang from Anaheim, California, led by a stocky, intense man known as Farmer John Griggs, held up a Hollywood producer at gunpoint and robbed him of his stash of Sandoz LSD. A week later, the bikers dropped the acid on a hill overlooking Palm Springs in Joshua Tree National Park. They must have seen the burning bush, for they threw away their guns and ran around the desert at midnight screaming, "This is it!" The next morning, Griggs and company roared back to Anaheim, determined to begin a new life. They experimented with psychedelics on a weekly basis and dabbled in mysticism. Griggs was the proselytizer, the moving spirit of the group. In the summer of 1966, he traveled to Millbrook to meet with Leary, who was quite taken by the ex-hoodlum. Quote, "Although unschooled and unlettered, he was an impressive person," Leary said of Griggs. "He had this charisma, that sparkle in his eye."
Well, Tim Leary was to hook up with the Brotherhood of Eternal Love in a very close way, as we're about to see. It should be noted that in order to finance that, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, and we're not going to go into any detail on this, became one of a number of different groups to found a sort of psychedelic religion. They considered themselves a religious organization. They supported their religious activities by, or alleged religious activities, would perhaps be a better way of putting it, by smuggling drugs in a big way. And that's the dealing operation alluded to here as we review or take a look at how Tim Leary hooked up with the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. The dealing operation was already in high gear when Timothy Leary decided to pull up roots and head for the West Coast, the mecca of hippiedom. By the spring of 1967, the Millbrook scene was collapsing. Three rival religious sects, the League for Spiritual Discovery, the Neo-American Boohoo Church, and a Hindu-oriented ashram, had taken up residence at the acid commune, and the entire place was under round-the-clock surveillance by the police. California beckoned, and Billy Hitchcock, the Millbrook patron, decided to move to the Bay Area. He gave Leary a parting check for $14,000 and sent him on his way after evicting everyone else from the estate. Leary and his new wife, a young ex-model named Rosemary, had a standing invitation from John Griggs to visit Laguna Beach. He was greeted by the Brotherhood like a private, heaven-sent prophet, and he acted the part, preaching to the group about love, peace, and enlightenment. Leary enjoyed the adulation as well as the town's mellow atmosphere. He and Rosemary rented a house near the ocean and spent much of their time dropping acid, lolling in the surf, and talking with the hippies on the beach. Take note here, by the way, before we move to the next section, of Billy Hitchcock. That's short for William Mellon Hitchcock, and that's Mellon as in Gulf Oil and the various other large American industrial enterprises, the Mellon family being one of the most prominent and powerful in the United States, Leary's patron at Millbrook, New York, and a fellow who himself had a lot of interesting connections, was a member of the Mellon family.
And again, not unlike Cappy Hubbard, Billy Hitchcock, William Mellon Hitchcock, as Dave so aptly pointed out, was somebody who frequently engaged in the psychedelic activities occurring at Millbrook and, in fact, subsidized the place. It was, in fact, his property, a huge, sprawling mansion and grounds. But at the same time, just like Cappy Hubbard, despite being a, quote, apostle of LSD, William Mellon Hitchcock was still daily bringing in his banker friends, his wheeler-dealer friends, and was, thrust to his shoulders in the world of entrepreneurial capitalism and perhaps, and we'll see later on, some slightly shadier things. So he was another person for whom the turn-on, tune-in, and drop-out axiom failed to hold true.
Yes, I dare say he never sold his Alcoa stock, even though he was preaching love, et cetera, et cetera.
Even though he was preaching the brotherhood of eternal love, as we shall also see. Continuing. All the notoriety surrounding Leary's movements and pronouncements was something of a mixed blessing for the Brotherhood. They were happy to provide living expenses for the acid guru and finance his frequent travels up to Berkeley, where he rented another house. But Leary attracted a lot of attention, which was exactly what a secret dope-smuggling outfit didn't need. Griggs and several of his cohorts decided to establish a second base of operations at a secluded ranch near Idlewild, California. They bought a 300-acre plot at the arid base of the Santa Ana Mountains to provide a safe haven for their extra-legal activities. The Brotherhood occupied a rundown farmhouse surrounded by a circle of 7 teepees and grew their own vegetables, which their wives and girlfriends dutifully cooked. A wooden watchtower camouflaged by eucalyptus trees enabled the dealers to spot any unwanted intruders moving up the winding road to their hideaway. They stayed high all the time, smoking as much as 30 joints per day per person, and dropping acid whenever the spirit moved them.
Next, we're going to take a look at William Mellon Hitchcock, who was, now bear in mind, he was the person who financed, who bankrolled Tim Leary and his LSD commune at Millbrook, New York. That was after Tim Leary got kicked out of Harvard University as a result of his LSD experimenting. And William Mellon Hitchcock not only bankrolled him at Millbrook, but then became the banker to the Brotherhood of Eternal Love and their LSD operation, well, their overall drug smuggling operation. It should be known that the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, as we said, became the largest underground supplier of LSD in the entire world, and we're going to take a look at just how they came by some of that shortly. Of William Mellon Hitchcock, the patron of Timothy Leary and the banker for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love after Leary hooked up with that group, the authors Schlein and Lee write as follows. Hitchcock served as banker for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, although later he insisted he was nothing more than a financial advisor. In truth, he had a lot to say about how things were done. According to Scully, he was involved in numerous planning sessions at his house in Sausalito. Sometimes after these meetings, they all got stoned and played Monopoly. Mr. Billy always won. But Hitchcock never expected to make big money from LSD. He was in it more for the adventure. He enjoyed his status as behind-the-scenes facilitator who brought people together and made connections. Most of all, he liked to party, and he wanted to see more folks turned on to acid. In the spring of 1968, Hitchcock and acid chemist Nick Sand journeyed to the Bahamas, where they stayed at the spacious mansion of Sam Clapp, that's spelled with 2 P's, chairman of the local fiduciary trust company. Clapp was a college chum of Hitchcock's, and they had been doing business together for years. They arranged for Sand to open an account under a false name at Clapp's bank. Hitchcock and Sand also looked into the feasibility of setting up an offshore LSD laboratory on one of Bahamas' secluded caves, which led some to wonder whether Mr. Billy was on a Dr. No trip, unquote. Fiduciary's hermetic banking provisions also appealed to the likes of Bernie Kornfeld and Seymour the Head Lazar, L-A-Z-A-R-E, directors of the Swiss-based Investors Overseas Services, or IOS, a fast money laundry for organized crime, corrupt third world dictators, wealthy expatriates, and freelance swindlers. We're going to read more about this from a footnote in a second. Kornfeld and Lazar were both acid veterans. Like everyone else, these hippie arbitrage experts needed a broker, and they found the boyish Mellon heir irresistible. That's H-E-I-R, by the way. Hitchcock took full advantage of his unlimited borrowing privileges at Fiduciary. At Clapp's urging, he poured over $5 million into unregistered letter stocks, the kind that aren't traded publicly but tend to show dramatic gains on paper, associated with the Mary Carter Paint Company, later known as Resorts International. It was the single largest chunk of money raised by Resorts, an organization suspected of having ties to organized crime. We're going to read a footnote about that, too. Resorts International proceeded to build a casino on an exclusive piece of Bahamian real estate called Paradise Island. A star-studded cast was on hand for the grand opening of the gambling spa, complete with tennis courts, swimming pools, albino beaches, and the clear blue waters of the Caribbean. It was New Year's Eve, 1968, and the guest of honor at this gala event was none other than Richard Nixon, who was about to launch a successful bid for the White House. James Crosby, president of Resorts International, contributed $100,000 to Nixon's campaign. Crosby and Bebe Rebozo, Nixon's best friend, mingled with a bevy of movie stars, jet-setters, gangsters, and GOP faithful. Billy Hitchcock was also there, idling among the heavies with drink in hand. And two footnotes about Investors Overseas Services and about Resorts International are provided by the authors. First of all, about IOS. At one point, Kornfeld imagined a critical cash shortage at IOS when there really was none. This set the stage for one of the largest frauds in the history of money. In 1971, an estimated $224 million was siphoned from IOS into the coffers of Robert Vesco, a heroin trafficker and financial contributor to Richard Nixon's 1972 presidential campaign. William Spector, S-P-E-C-T-O-R, a former OSS operative, claimed that Vesco's tangled web of corporations served as fronts for various CIA activities and provided cover for CIA agents. And in a footnote to Resorts International, Eddie Cellini, C-E-L-L-I-N-I, the brother of a longtime associate of Meyer Lansky, served as the casino manager for Resorts International. Louis Chesler, C-H-E-S-L-E-R, another Lansky crony, and Wallace Groves, who allegedly had CIA connections, were both partners in a gambling venture with Mary Carter / Resorts. In 1970, Resorts International formed a private intelligence corporation called Intertel, which was staffed largely by ex-CIA, NSA, BNDD, Interpol, and Justice Department officials. Intertel rented its services to a wide range of corporate clients, including ITT, McDonald's, and Howard Hughes Sewer Corporation.
Continuing. In addition to his dealings with Resorts International, Billy Hitchcock maintained a private account at Castle Bank and Trust, a funny money repository in the Bahamas that catered to mobsters, entertainers, drug dealers, and Republican Party fat cats, the same crowd that boozed it up whenever Resorts threw a party on Paradise Isle. A certain Richard M. Nixon was among 300 prominent Americans who used Castle to deposit their cash. The bank's clientele included actor Tony Curtis, the rock group Creedence Clearwater Revival, Playboy publisher Hugh Hefner, Bob Guccione's Penthouse, Chiang Kai-shek's daughter and her husband, and billionaire eccentric Howard Hughes. Castle Bank was no ordinary financial institution. Originally set up by the CIA as a funding conduit for a wide range of covert operations in the Caribbean, this sophisticated money wash was part of a vast worldwide financial network managed by American intelligence. Specifically, the agency used Castle Bank to facilitate the hidden transfer of huge sums to finance subversion, paramilitary operations, an occasional coup d'etat, bribery, and payments to foreign informants. Castle played a key role in funding the CIA's secret war against Cuba, a campaign that drew upon, quote, the patriotic services of mob hit teams assembled at the behest of the agency to assassinate Fidel Castro. The syndicate, seeking to return to the days when Havana was the brothel of the Caribbean, had a score to settle with the Cuban president. They also had much to gain from a cozy relationship with the CIA, whose clandestine financial network provided a perfect shield for criminal activities. In effect, Castle Bank was an intelligence front that covered for the mob. Billy Hitchcock wasn't the only figure in the Mellon clan who rubbed shoulders with the espionage community. A number of Mellons served in the OSS, notably David Bruce, the OSS station chief in London, whose father-in-law, Andrew Mellon, was Treasury Secretary during the Depression. After the war, certain influential members of the Mellon family maintained close ties with the CIA. Mellon family foundations had been used repeatedly as conduits for agency funds. Furthermore, Richard Helms was a frequent weekend guest of the Mellon patriarchs in Pittsburgh during his tenure as CIA director. We're going to read a footnote here about Castle Bank. Castle Bank was founded and controlled by Paul Helliwell, H-E-L-L-I-W-E-L-L, a Miami lawyer with long-standing ties to American intelligence. Helliwell's career as a spook dates back to World War II, when he served as chief of special intelligence in China with the OSS. He stayed in the Far East when the CIA was formed and bossed a bevy of spies, including E. Howard Hunt of Watergate fame. In the early 1950s, Helliwell organized Sea Supply, a CIA proprietary company that furnished weapons and other material to anti-communist guerrillas in the hills of Burma, Laos, and Thailand. Based in the Golden Triangle, this mercenary army cultivated fields of opium poppies, and the CIA was drawn immediately into the drug connection. Helliwell also served as paymaster for the ill-fated Bay of Pigs operation in 1961. A few years later, he set up Castle Bank, serving in a dual capacity as CIA banker and legal counsel for the Cuban Mafia, which prospered by selling Southeast Asian heroin in the U.S. Helliwell's law firm also represented Louis Chesler and Wallace Groves, both partners in Resorts International. So as always, when we get to working with CIA proprietaries and CIA-allied banks, the connections are so deep and fibrous, as Dave put, as to be virtually inseparable, trying to find out where anything resembling a legitimate or at least an autonomous business leaves off and the CIA and the Mafia begin.
So again, the patron of Timothy Leary at Millbrook and the fellow who served as the banker for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, William Mellon Hitchcock, has numerous intelligence and organized crime connections, banked at CIA and mob-connected institutions, and so the whole question of the financing of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love and to what extent it was involved with the intelligence community is, again, something very important to ask. And food for thought and grounds for further research. Some of that research we're going to do or present to you this evening. Back to the subject of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, we're going to take a look now at the introduction of a man named Ronald Hadley Stark to the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. This took place in the summer of 1969 when some unpleasant changes were affecting Timothy Leary and the folks at Idlewild, California. Returning again to Acid Dreams. In July of 1969, Charlene Almeida, A-L-M-E-I-D-A, a teenage friend of Leary's daughter, drowned in a pond at the ranch. An autopsy revealed traces of LSD in her blood, provoking a raid by the Riverside County Sheriff. Leary was charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and five brothers were sent to jail on pot charges. But the greatest setback occurred in early August when farmer John Griggs took an overdose of PCP. Griggs refused medical assistance as he lay dying in a teepee at Idlewild. "It's just between me and God," he muttered softly before passing away. In the aftermath of Griggs' death, there was a shake-up in the Brotherhood hierarchy. A different breed took over, and their approach to dealing was more competitive and cutthroat than before. Robert Fat Bobby Andrist, A-N-D-R-I-S-T, became the kingpin of the hashish operation. His counterparts in the LSD trade were Michael Boyd Randall and Nick Sand, who controlled a network that included over 30 regional distributors. They unloaded orange sunshine in parcels of 80 to 250,000, and the supply was quickly dwindling. Sand wanted to commence another manufacturing run, but he was stymied by a lack of raw materials. Hitchcock's source in Europe had dried up, leaving the brothers in the lurch. It was at this point that a mysterious figure named Ronald Hadley Stark appeared on the scene. The first time anyone heard of Stark was when one of his emissaries turned up in New York to see Hitchcock. The man claimed to represent a large French LSD operation. He was seeking to unload his product through covert channels. Hitchcock, who was then trying to distance himself from the drug trade, directed his visitor to the Brotherhood Ranch. A few weeks later, Stark and his assistant traveled to Idlewild. The brothers were hesitant initially, but after some verbal sparring, Stark proved his sincerity by showing them a kilo of pure LSD. This was a rather impressive credential, to say the least. None of the brothers had ever seen that much acid in one place before. Stark informed them that he had discovered a new quick process of making high-quality LSD. He laid out his plan to turn on the world, not just the West, but the Soviet Union and the communist countries as well. Stark had business contacts with the Japanese mafia, and they could smuggle drugs into the Chinese mainland. He also knew a high-placed Tibetan close to the Dalai Lama. Why not offer him enough LSD to dose all the Chinese troops occupying Tibet? The CIA was then training Tibetan exiles for guerrilla actions in their former homeland, and the hallucinogen would come in handy. The brothers dug his rap. "We were definitely very gullible in believing the stuff he told us," Scully said.
Continuing, Stark's talent as a raconteur was enhanced by an insatiable appetite for intrigue and deception. He was adept at dropping names, dates, and places that would change depending upon the situation. At various times, he passed himself off as a medical doctor, a gourmet cook, a professional chemist, a collector of fine art. Every story he told was slightly different, and no one knew for certain who he really was. His net worth in 1967 was a paltry $3,000, but a year later he was a millionaire. Stark claimed a relationship to the Whitneys, one of America's richest clans, and attributed his sudden wealth to the deft handling of a family trust fund. Stark maintained an expensive apartment in Greenwich Village and liked to dine at the best restaurants in immaculate three-piece suits. Yet, whenever he visited the Brotherhood Ranch, he put on a smelly jalaba or a rumpled shirt and grease-stained tie. 5'8", with a bulging waistline, high forehead, and thick brooding mustache, he could easily come off as a schlub, but his motley appearance belied a ruthless and cunning intelligence. Although only in his early 30s, Stark spoke 10 languages fluently, including French, German, Italian, Arabic, and Chinese. He was, in short, a genius con artist who could talk circles around just about anybody. Stark presented himself to the brothers as the premier fixer, the man who could get anything done. He came across as someone who really knew his way around the world of international finance, claiming to sit on numerous boards of numerous corporations, some legitimate, others illegitimate, that he alone controlled. He promised to use his connections to help the brothers. Stark warned them that buying real estate openly, as they had done, was much too risky, but his lawyers could remedy the situation by hiding ownership in a maze of shell companies. Before long, he assumed Hitchcock's role as banker and money manager for the brothers' dirty cash. But Stark got much more involved than Hitchcock, overseeing the production end of the LSD operation in addition to the finances. As Eminence Grise of the psychedelic movement, he had a lot going in his favor, principally a reliable source of raw materials from Czechoslovakia and an excellent manufacturing facility in Paris, which had already produced large quantities of LSD in crystalline form. The acid was dyed orange so as to continue the Sunshine legacy, and the brothers tabbed and distributed it. Meanwhile, the redoubtable Stark dashed to and fro, attending to various business scams in at least a dozen countries. Like a chameleon, he moved swiftly from underground drug factories and hippie communes to posh hotels and private clubs for the rich and famous. He maneuvered on four continents, leaving a trail of ambiguities at every turn. A master of innuendo and disinformation, he preferred to keep his range of contacts ignorant of each other's activities. Oftentimes, he concealed the fact that he was an American. His European associates were not privy to his affairs in Africa, and those in Asia knew little about his work in the States. The brothers, for example, had no idea that he was running a separate cocaine ring in the Bay Area. Stark compartmentalized the different spheres of his life, managing everything on a need-to-know basis. His modus operandi was not unlike that of an intelligence operative. He often claimed to know exactly how things worked in the espionage community. He said he knew lots of spies, and to some of his friends he even boasted of working for the CIA. It was a tip from the agency, he explained, that prompted him to shut down his French operation in 1971. A few months later, he opened another sophisticated production center in Brussels, which masqueraded for 2 years as a reputable firm engaged in biomedical research. During this period, Stark communicated on a regular basis with officials at the American Embassy in London. He even elicited their assistance while setting up his Belgian drug lab. By the time it was all over, Stark had made 20 kilos of LSD, enough for 50 million doses. It was by far the largest amount of acid ever to emanate from a single underground source, and most of it was sold in the United States. Let me run this one again. This is 1971, by the way. By the time it was all over, Stark had made 20 kilos of LSD, enough for 50 million doses. It was by far the largest amount of acid ever to emanate from a single underground source, and most of it was sold in the United States. So Ron Stark, a man with equally strange political connections as Billy Hitchcock, but with a great deal more mysteriousness in his behavior and movements, throws himself into the middle of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, takes over the operation, gets involved not only in the money angle but the distribution angle of it, and proceeds to put together 50 million hits of LSD, the largest amount ever distributed.
Right, and again, this is a fellow who functions in a manner very reminiscent of the intelligence community, who boasted of having intelligence connections, and that boast appears to be very, very substantive, as we're going to see in an examination, a closer examination of the career of Ronald Hadley Stark. Continuing with acid dreams. The fact that Stark was wanted on a drug rap in the U.S. hardly put a damper on his international escapades. He spent much of his time in Italy during the 1970s, cavorting with Sicilian mafiosi, Secret Service officials, and political extremists of the far left and far right. Stark's antics took him far afield. Occasionally, he traveled to the Baalbek region of Lebanon, where he negotiated with a Shiite Muslim sect for shiploads of hashish. Stark claimed to be a business representative of Imam Musa Sadr, a powerful Shiite warlord who controlled vast hashish plantations and a private army of 6,000 men. The area under his dominion was said to include training camps used by the Palestine Liberation Organization and other terrorist groups. Back in Italy, Stark rented a small apartment in Florence, but he rarely stayed there, preferring the posh hotels of Rome, Milan, Bologna, and other cities. By day, he carried on as a smooth and successful businessman. At night, he donned a pair of faded blue jeans and a work shirt and mingled with student radicals and other extremists. Moving in left-wing circles was nothing new for Ronald Stark. He had a knack for popping up wherever trouble was brewing. An American expatriate bumped into him on the streets of Paris during the peak of the Sorbonne uprising in 1968. In London, he frequented the clubs and bars that were hangouts for dissident elements, and he made his first appearance in Milan during the hot autumn of 1969, when massive student demonstrations and labor strikes nearly paralyzed Italy. Furthermore, Stark was tight with the Brotherhood leaders who contributed money to the Weather Underground for Timothy Leary's prison escape. Whatever game Stark was playing took an abrupt turn in February of 1975, when Italian police received an anonymous phone call about a man selling drugs in a hotel in Bologna. A few days later, at the Grand Hotel Baglioni, they arrested a suspect in possession of 4,600 kilos of marijuana, morphine, and cocaine. The suspect carried a British passport bearing the name of Mr. Terence W. Abbott, A-B-B-O-T-T. Italian investigators soon discovered that Mr. Abbott was actually Ronald Stark. Among his belongings was the key to a safe deposit box in Rome that contained documents on the manufacture of LSD and a synthetic version of cocaine. There was also a vial of liquid that scientists could not precisely identify. They figured it was something like LSD. Other items seized by police included letters from a certain Charles C. Adams written on stationery with the letterhead of the American Embassy in London. The messages from Adams, a Foreign Service officer, began with a confidential "Dear Ron," and were addressed to Stark's drug laboratory in Brussels, which had been raided in the fall of 1972 by a team of American agents. If Stark's contacts with the American embassy personnel were difficult to fathom, then his association with some of Italy's most notorious terrorists was equally curious. In the spring of 1976, while he was being held in Don Bosco prison in Pisa, Stark befriended Renato Curcio, C-U-R-C-I-O, a top leader of the Red Brigades that had stalked Italy since the early 1970s. Curcio and his radical cohorts apparently had no idea that Stark was an American when they took him into their confidence. As soon as he succeeded in penetrating the underground terrorist network, Stark asked prison officials to arrange a meeting with the chief prosecutor of Pisa. He said that Curcio had told him of a plot to assassinate Judge Francesco Cocco of Genoa, who was scheduled to preside over a trial of 50 Red Brigadesmen. There was also talk of abducting a prominent Italian politician who lived in Rome. In June of 1976, Judge Cocco was murdered just as Stark predicted. Aldo Moro, five times Italy's premier, may have been the other victim. Stark's name would later surface in connection with the Moro kidnapping and execution.
Before we go on, we might mention that, of course, the Aldo Moro killing and execution, as with so many of these other things, are things we've talked about at great length. The Red Brigades, remember, that we're talking about are an organization that we have found out that were actually founded by Licio Gelli, the arch-fascist grandmaster of the Italian Propaganda Due Masonic Lodge, which was not really a Masonic lodge, but a secret shadow fascist government of Italy comprising a large number of Italy's leading intelligence, military, political, and banking figures. years. You will notice, again, that for a man who is supposedly just a kind of a wild cowboy drug dealer and con man, Ronald Hadley Stark has a lot of very important friends on the slightly more conservative side of the political spectrum.
Right, and one of the things that's interesting about Ronald Stark, and we're going to go into his Italian doings at great length here with an essay by Jonathan Marshall, one of the interesting things about Stark is his contacts with the ultra-left and the ultra-right. One of the things we looked at in our five-part Radio Free America series about the P2 Lodge in Italian politics was the P2-related Italian Secret Services habits of controlling terrorism on both the right and the left, one of the major features of the Stefano Della Chiaia-inspired strategy of tension. And it's worth evaluating Ronald Stark here in the context of the five-part series Radio Free America's 17 through 21 on the Mediterranean merry-go-round.
Continuing from where Dave left off in Acid Dreams. Transferred to a jail in Bologna, Stark continued to expand his terrorist contacts. During this period, he received a steady flow of visitors from the British and American consulates. Curiously, the U.S. government never pressed for his extradition, even though he was wanted on drug charges related to the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. Stark also communicated on a regular basis with representatives of the Libyan Diplomatic Corps and had a series of meetings with Italian Secret Service personnel. Documents show that he was in direct contact with General Vito Micheli, M-I-C-E-L-I, who received $800,000 from the CIA during the early 1970s while serving as chief of Italian military intelligence. Micheli was later implicated in a series of neo-fascist coup attempts in Italy. It was quite a juggling act, to be sure, and a judge in Bologna eventually sentenced Stark to 14 years imprisonment and a $60,000 fine for drug trafficking. At his appeals trial, Stark changed identities once again, this time passing himself off as Khoury Ali, K-H-O-U-R-I, Khoury Ali, a radical Palestinian. In fluent Arabic, he spelled out the details of his autobiography, explaining that he was part of an international terrorist organization headquartered in Lebanon called Group 14. Stark's appeal failed, and he was sent back to jail. But Italian police took a renewed interest in his case after they captured Enrique Paghera, another terrorist leader who knew Stark. At the time of his arrest, Paghera was holding a hand-drawn map of a PLO camp in Lebanon. The map, Paghera confessed, had come from Stark, who also provided a coded letter of introduction. The objective, according to Paghera, was to forge a link with a terrorist organization that was planning to attack embassies. In June 1978, Graziano Gori, a magistrate in Bologna, was assigned to investigate and clarify Stark's ties to the U.S., the Arabs, Italian terrorists, and other mysteries. A few weeks later, Gori was killed in a car accident. The Italian government subsequently charged Stark with armed banditry for his role in aiding and abetting terrorist activities. But he never stood trial on these charges. True to form, Stark dropped out of sight shortly after he was released from prison in April 1979 on orders from Judge Giorgio Floridia in Bologna. The judge's decision was extraordinary. He released Stark because of, quote, an impressive series of scrupulously enumerated proofs that Stark was actually a CIA agent. Quote, many circumstances suggest that from 1960 onwards, Stark belonged to the American Secret Services, Floridia stated.
That shouldn't come as too much of a surprise in light of some of the activities that we see Ronald Stark involved in. Now, bear in mind, this is the chief LSD manufacturer for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. This is the man who manufactured the largest single underground source of LSD in history and who was the main supplier of the LSD subculture, I guess one could call it, during the late 1960s and early 1970s. The indications are, not only from Judge Floridia's conclusion, but from the facts as we are about to examine them and have already to a smaller extent, are that in fact Ronald Hadley Stark was a CIA agent. It's interesting that he should be connected to members of the Libyan Diplomatic Corps. Of course, we've looked at the Libyan situation at great length in various past archive shows, particularly those in connection with the Triple Wilson team and in connection with the Olympics massacre. It's also interesting that he should be buddies of General Vito Micheli. Micheli is a key member of the P2 Lodge, also an Italian parliamentary representative for the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, which is the Italian Fascist Party. The nominal head of the MSI at the last word we had was a fellow named Vittorio Mussolini. And if the last name rings a bell, it's because he is the son of Il Duce. Now, this is an interesting fellow to be hanging around with Ronald Hadley Stark. And as we're going to see, Stark had a lot of other very, very interesting friends. His Middle Eastern connections are interesting. It's interesting, too, that Judge Graziano Gori, who was investigating Stark's ties to the United States, Arabs, and Italian terrorists, should die in an automobile accident. During our five-part series on Italian politics, the P2, the shooting of the Pope, etc., we took a look at the large number of Italian magistrates who either were killed or were almost killed when they began looking into one aspect or another of the fascist activities of Licio Gelli's P2 Lodge.
Indeed. And the Middle Eastern activities, well, it's all very reminiscent of that whole series of I guess you'd have to call them gray agents like Turple Wilson et al., who are obviously doing the CIA's bidding. They are obviously doing things that are useful to the CIA, all under the cloak of anonymity, of being private businessmen. But time and time again, with the contacts in the right places, in the high places, they are doing what they are supposed to do to further the CIA's aims, but then, of course, they have complete deniability. And the difference here is that instead of talking about the normal arms shipments and assassinations, we're talking about somebody who basically supplied a large portion of the American drug culture that is thought of by most people as being an indigenous part of the resistance to the American right wing in this country.
And again, it should be noted that some of the very same gray areas, the Middle East, the PLO connections, are some of the very ones that not only intersect with the Mediterranean merry-go-round, but that Turple and Wilson were so heavily involved with, as well as members of the Galen Organization and others we've spoken about in past broadcasts. It's also interesting that William Mellon Hitchcock, the banker for the very activities that Ronald Hadley Stark was executing, was, and perhaps the term execute is a good one in the context, as we're going to be looking at Stark some more here after our break. It should be noted, too, that William Mellon Hitchcock intersects with the very same organized crime and Cuban mafia and intelligence connections that the great heroin coup focused on so heavily. Our last two Radio Free America shows have dealt with the Cuban mafia and their inextricable link to the CIA at great length, and it's worth noting that the fellow who is bankrolling Ronald Hadley Stark's LSD activities, William Mellon Hitchcock, the patron of Timothy Leary, is, again, inextricably linked with that very same milieu.
Yeah, it was also interesting that that in the book, Lee and Schlein noted that Stark had told somebody that it was a CIA tip that had led him to close his Paris lab, which in 1971, at a time that coincided almost exactly with the time that the move was being put on the French drug trade by the Nixon White House, ostensibly to shut down the drug trade, but of course, as we have seen in detail at great length on these broadcasts, in fact, merely to bring the drug trade under the direct control of American intelligence to be used in a more worthwhile way for funding American covert activities. Well, we're going to be getting into Ronald H. Stark's strange cohorts a little more when we get back from yet another break, and that's what we're going to take right now. So don't go away.
Yes, people who eventually hear this via rebroadcast or who are listening to it on tape, the next section will be on the next cassette side after this one. This will be the last material on this side.
This is Nip Tuck. Dave Emery and I will return with more Radio Free America in just a few minutes right here on...